If you've watched news reports about Iraq over the past 8 years, you're probably familiar with Michael Ware. As a journalist for Time magazine and CNN, he's built a bit of a reputation for going where some other reporters fear to tread. So how does a boy from Brisbane end up in a war zone? And what toll does something like that take? Michael Ware, good to talk to you from across the desk rather than from across a few oceans.
Yes.
Dodging bullets.
It's rather a change.
I bet it's rather a change. For those of who may not know your background, how does someone from Brisbane end up a war reporter in Iraq?
I'm continually wondering that myself, to be perfectly honest.
But what was it? What was it in you, and at what stage? I mean, we were young reporters together.
I was just telling someone that this morning. I said, I remember when we were in that dodgy newsroom at the Courier-Mail. Not that it's any less dodgy now.
I wore pigtails in my hair, and you were no more sophisticated.
Oh, absolutely not. I'd just fallen out of the law. I remember getting that phone call from the Courier-Mail way back then going, have you ever thought about being a journalist? And I went, no, not really.
Well, you haven't since then.
Yeah, and we said, let's try it for a year and see how it goes. And
so
now look at me.
What was it in that year that made you think? Was it Iraq? Was it reporting from a war zone? Was it something that you wanted to get away from?
To be honest, I just knew I didn't want to do the law. And I was setting off on the backpacking thing. Mm-hmm. And there was a rather far-seeing or insightful chief of staff at the Courier-Mail, Dennis Watt, who now runs the place, who came and said, you know, would you like to have a go? And it honestly wasn't even in my mind.
And so you said yes, and have a go. What does the have a go meant?
That was just to become a journalist, full stop. And in fact, it was quite cool. He said to me, once I got the job as a third-year cadet, remember those days? He said, would you like to be our war correspondent? Now, and I was very keen. I said, oh, fantastic. He said, wait, I haven't told you which war yet. It was World War II, because that was the year of Australia Remembers. Remember that? The 50th anniversary of the end of World War II. And I have to admit, the 6 months I spent covering the Australia Remembers program, to this day stands me in good stead. I mean, I went literally and interviewed hundreds of diggers, veterans.
But was it that made you think, I'm unsatisfied, I actually want to get on a plane and go over there and report from a war zone?
My first touch with it, long before I even thought about journalism, I mean, I was at high school, I was hell-bent on becoming a lawyer. But I remember the day in 1985, when the newspapers were full of the news of the death of this bloke I'd never heard of, an Australian by the name of Neil Davis. He was a Tassie bloke, cameraman. I think he was working for the ABC at that point. Anyway, he went to Vietnam in the mid-60s for a six-week stint and essentially never came home. And he died on the streets of Bangkok during, you know, one of those, rather pissant, coup d'etats that Thailand has as part of its political process. The great irony being he'd survived Vietnam, he'd survived Cambodia, and there as bureau chief in Bangkok.
As a journalist,
as a cameraman, dies in a nothing event, on an afternoon in the streets of Bangkok. And that's his story. Stayed with me.
And was it his story that got you on a plane, or what got you on that plane out of Australia to Iraq?
Well, it all started with Timor, to be honest. The guts of the Timor story had passed me by. I remember in 1999, with all that horrible violence and so forth, and the Aussies led the international task force.
Yeah.
It was almost as an afterthought, but working back then for the Courier and the News Limited group in Australia, I was sent in as sort of a last-minute, relief person to cover the Christmas of December 99. I ended up staying 5 months in Timor. And I came home after Interfet came home. And I went, that was my first taste of a foreign story. And secondly, it was my first brush with the international, news community. And I went, oh, well, this is a bit of all right. They do this for a living. And so I came home and told the then editor of the Courier that no one wanted to keep doing that. And he said, well, we have no place for that. And I said, I know, that's why I'm telling you that I'm looking for something else. And then I was lucky enough to be picked up by Time magazine, of all people.
So you got to Iraq. Tell me, when you...
Iraq itself. By the time I got to Iraq, this story begins, as so many tragic others do, with 9/11. I mean, as with so many others, my life has never been the same since 9/11. Since 9/11, I have lived war. And until recently, I didn't visit and I didn't do rotations and I didn't come and go. I lived. I mean, I will argue the toss with the Australian Tax Office, but, you know, I'm still a resident of the Republic of Iraq.
Why? Why?
Why?
Is it the people? Is it that you think you do?
No, it's the, I mean, God bless my Iraqi brothers, but, Allah, as the case may be. It's the fascination. I mean, it is just intellectually, you know, it's the most gripping thing that I've ever seen or imagined. I mean, because after 9/11, I lived for a year in Afghanistan. And again, I went as on a 3-week relief stint and I stayed 13 months, most of which was spent living in Kandahar, the home, the, you know, the heartland of the Taliban, where they were born. Much of that period as the only Westerner still in the city, because they'd bombed the Red Cross and done this and done that, and I lived as an Afghan. And so by the time the Iraq War came along, rather than just being a sub on the bench, Time Magazine, I was the first cab off the rank, and you know, I was going to Iraq with bells on. Now, you know, and the Middle East had never been an area of particular concern to mine. I mean, I was absolutely focused on Indonesia and Southeast Asia. But it's incredible. I mean, it operates on several levels. First and foremost, I've been given the privilege of having a front row ticket to history, watching firsthand as it unfolds before me.
So tell us about that front row ticket. What do you see? What do you feel? Tell us about the Iraqis. Obviously, your affinity with the Iraqi people is huge. It's enormous.
Yeah, it is. It is. And with the Afghans too. And there's been a few wars sprinkled in between. So you lose track. But in one sense, there's two levels, I guess. In one sense, in war, you see humanity stripped bare. Mm. I mean, it's kind of trite to say. But until you've seen it, you have absolutely no idea. The sense of watching seeing a community in upheaval really gives you it sharpens your own awareness of what's important and what's not, let alone, you know, the near-death experience kind of business. But seeing that, I mean, and to see how societies cope, to see how humans cope, I mean, seeing little kids still smiling and laughing and kicking a beat-up old, can like a football in a refugee camp when they've lost everything and dad's missing, I mean, that never ceases to amaze me. And to see good men do evil and to see evil men do good, I mean, it's life stripped bare. And certainly once you're in that moment in combat, you know, when the lead's thick in the air, I mean, there's no room. There's no room whatsoever for I normally call it something else, but for those little lies that we tell ourselves each and every day. We all get up each morning and go through our day fudging a couple of little things here and there, you know, telling ourselves, oh, we will do this, or we will, oh, I can. In those moments, you cannot hide from yourself. And so it tells you about yourself as well.
When you say you learn things about yourself, what have you learned about yourself that you didn't know beforehand?
Well, I'm not sure I really want to inform the state on that, to be honest. But I mean, you know, for example, if, you know, in a unit, you'll see the, you know, it's almost like a caricature from every, you know, World War II movie. There's always the great big burly bloke carrying the M60 or the saw, as they're called. He, you know, is the bravest and the, you know, come on, get some. Under heavy fire, he might be the one who's curled up crying. Mm. But then the next day, he's the one who charges the Al-Qaeda bunker. You know what I mean? There's no room, I'm going to say, there's no room for bullshit. I mean, all that stuff that pads our lives just is stripped bare.
And that's the reason.
And you find out exactly who you are, how brave, how not, how true, how not, and what's important. When you're sitting there waiting, I remember one time when I was grabbed by the bad boys, and by Al-Qaeda, you know, and I was making my peace. You know, they were my last moments. No one can explain why I'm still here after that one. But I mean,
And when you were making that piece, what went through your head? You say,
well, you know, I really don't want to inform the people of Queensland of what's going on inside.
Everything's stripped bare. You think you're going to die.
Yeah.
Does it matter that you're in a war zone? Do you regret being there in the first place?
No.
Or you just live in that couple of minutes?
Yeah, I mean, you haven't got time. You almost haven't got time.
But this is when you were kidnapped, no doubt.
And yeah, one of the times, yeah.
And your fixers have been kidnapped too.
Yeah.
How do you hold yourself together in a situation like that, or don't you?
As I'm now learning, you sort of, you process things as you go, but you kind of don't. I mean, in relation to that one particular kidnap when Al-Qaeda grabbed me, I am very fortunate. I mean, I'm the only Westerner to have been kidnapped by Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and he lived to tell the tale. And I say that, you know, that just rolls off my tongue, that phrase. And I've never stopped to think about what it actually, the only Westerner. Before I left the States in December, I had to do a job for CNN where I went to Memphis to interview this a fellow, an American contractor who'd been kidnapped in Iraq. I was there when he was kidnapped. And he was one of the few who actually got rescued. Now, he wasn't kidnapped by Al-Qaeda. He was kidnapped by criminals. But he was entombed in the ground for 11 months. They used to concrete over his thing every 3 days and chip away at it and put food in, take something out and concrete over again. He survived 11 months like that. Anyway, he was then rescued. We're sitting down, we're doing an interview. And the idea was from CNN, you know, kidnap victim interviews a kidnap victim. It was only afterwards when I read the transcript of our interview that I looked at the questions that I was asking.
Yeah.
And I was saying, well, when they grabbed me on the street that day, it was as if it was happening to another person.
Yes.
And he went, near-death, out-of-body experience. And I went, yeah, was it like that for you? I had no idea it felt like that to me. And what that told me was that whilst I dealt with it at the time, I mean, when I got home that morning, I went to my bedroom and I didn't leave it for 3 days. And then there was an attempt on my life at that point. So eventually I went and put America's first infantry division between me and the killers trying to get me. And it was through the Battle of Fallujah that I actually got over this. I mean, every time I got in the car, I had a sinking feeling that I wanted to throw up. So I dealt with it at the time and moved forward. But it's like I put the emotions away in a box, gaffer taped them up and put them in the attic.
So what happens?
And now I'm finding the attic's absolutely chock-a-block full of gaffer tape boxes.
You hinted at the toll this takes on someone who's been in your situation.
Mm. Yeah, it's not just in my situation. Imagine kids growing up in this stuff. I remember during the Iraqi Civil War when they were butchering each other on the streets, like the kids here in Toowong. Wake up in the morning and they meet their mate on the street to kick a footy and there's the next door neighbour's headless body. I mean, for goodness sakes. You know, and obviously it's silly to say that, you know, you're not the same person.
So you're not the same person?
Of course not. I mean, obviously, but I mean, the depth to which you change and the fundamental nature of that change is breathtaking.
Is there a level of regret that you put yourself through this?
Hell no. I regret that I'd put my family through it. I mean, the ones who really pay for this are those who love us, the poor fools.
Because they don't know what's happening. They don't know if you're dead or alive.
Can you imagine? They just say, you know, 9 years of just quietly wondering and that.
Do they have rules that you've got to call in or email every so often?
And if they did, I wouldn't follow them anyway. I mean, the war dictates that, not you. Certainly not anyone back here. So, I mean, you know, certainly from our perspective, you know, from an Australian perspective, it's about, you know, yes, the journalists who go and the diggers. You're never the same again. And certainly in my experience, you'll never come home. I mean, not home.
Not to where you were before.
Nothing's ever the same. I mean, like one of the hardest things is, you know, for me, for example, I know a lot of soldiers experience this, it's finding traction again back here. I mean,
I was wondering because we were just listening
nothing
to the news.
Nothing seems real.
No, and we were listening to the news together and you weren't interested at all.
Because, oh, totally oblivious. I mean,
because news isn't really news.
Well, I heard you talking about the electricity bill and all I could think about was, well, go and buy a goddamn generator, people. I mean, in Baghdad, you get 1 hour of electricity a day and you think Brisbane's hot? God damn, you got no idea. And excuse me. $240 a year? Oh, grow up, people. Come on. At least you've got electricity. Yeah, I mean, that's the sort of way, you know, and I know that's wrong and it ignores a lot of, you know, just day-to-day realities.
Yeah.
I mean, please. But I'm thinking about people who have got, you know, say new preemie babies. And there's no hospital to take care of them. I mean, you should see the preemie ward in Baghdad Hospital, please. And it's stinking hot. It gets to 52 degrees. And there's not a lick of electricity, and there hasn't been for 3 days. And you're living in a slum, and everyone keeps showing up dead. I mean, come on. So it's hard to get beyond that. And you know, it's no great shock. And it's a matter of public note now that I'm, you know, I have post-traumatic stress syndrome.
You do have that? That's been diagnosed?
Disorder. And it's actually been made very, very public of late. And
what does that mean? What have they explained to you it means?
They don't need to explain anything, I can tell you now. I mean, you know, there's a whole series of things that people who go through traumatic events, you know, they can experience.
Is it impossible to go through what you have gone through and not experience it?
Well, I don't know if it's impossible, but you don't walk away untouched. I mean, physically, you know, I've been very, very lucky. My wounds have been minor, just scrapes. But no one comes home untouched. There's the wounds that you can see and the wounds that you can't see.
Do the people in Iraq get post-traumatic stress too?
Yeah, it's called being Iraqi. Of course they do, but they have to push on. They don't get to come home. And, you know, don't get me started. I mean, I guess the PTSD kicks in the lack of perspective here. But, I mean, talking about Australia and refugees and immigration, it just offends me. Talking about, you know, the things that we trouble ourselves with and tie ourselves up in knots with when really in the grand scheme, you know, it's not that important.
But there are things you worried about too. You can't have a go at people in a sense. But,
no.
But 20
that's
years
the thing
ago
I'm
you would have.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
I had nothing else to worry about.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what the real world was like. Because this is not the real world.
But
This is a bubble.
How do we
floating
learn
on the sea of humanity.
How do we each day get out of our bubble and understand
oh,
a little
God
bit
knows,
more?
Oh, God knows. I have no idea. I'm trying to get back in the bubble. That I can't do. You know, and like for post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, there can be the involuntary reliving of a near-death experience. Well, I don't have that. I've had too many of them. There's disassociation, sleeplessness, you know, the nightmares, the mood swings, this is that, you know, the hypervigilance. Right now, I can tell you how safe this building is for a bombing and how prime it is, how well a car bomb would go off in your car park underneath. It'd be an absolute corker. They're the things I see. I still sit with my back to a wall in a restaurant. Actually, I don't go to restaurants. I don't go out.
So did you realise you were having this problem or did someone else tap you on the shoulder and say, Michael?
No, I mean, I'm not a fool. I mean, when I went to my first conflict, even Timor, you know, I was aware of PTSD. I saw the vets come home from Vietnam, for goodness sakes, and the crappy way we treated them, which is not happening today. So, no, I was waiting for, you know, I was alert and I read. But, no, it took me kicking and screaming to bring it to people's attention. That and the fact they could no longer ignore it once I was, you know, going off the deep end.
And so what happens from here?
Well, allegedly I'm writing a book. That's what I'm home for.
Is that therapeutic or is that a silly move?
Well, inshallah. Hopefully it will be. That was Arabic, by the way.
Yeah, what were you telling me?
That means God willing.
Okay.
We hope so. It's been 6 months. I haven't written a word. Every notebook I touch, every piece of paper, every video I watch, every memento I pull out of a box is laden with memory.
But yet you want to write a book and you want to go back to Iraq?
Oh, yeah. Well,
why?
I mean, I don't want to live in Iraq anymore. Now, that's the thing. There's a difference between living war and visiting war. That's what most people do is visit war.
Mm.
And there's a difference between doing a one-year tour as a grunt or a digger and living there nonstop for like seven. I think that was a bit excessive, looking back.
And people probably tried to tell you that along the way, family included.
Yeah, I suppose. But that's the other thing. I mean, you know, front row ticket to history. Also, it's so engaging. It's like...
It's a drug.
Chess. It's like, you know, this intellectual chess, but with violence and armies. And the other thing is the truth. The truth. I mean, you know... Tony Abbott actually admitted that they all, you know, tell us porkies. Well, in war, everyone lies. Our government, their government, the so-called good guys, the so-called bad guys, even the civilians. You know, Tim O'Brien wrote this book after Vietnam, and he says there's no such thing as a true war story. And that is true. And so you just to get behind it and to see it is just, it is a gift. Now, that gift comes with a price.
And you're paying the price, is what you're saying.
Well, so do the diggers. And that's what annoys me so much about, you know, successive Australian administrations, you know, federal governments, their media policy on the soldiers, on the diggers. I mean, it is unbelievable. Our diggers are sweating and bleeding in a vacuum. And they're kept in that vacuum where it's over there, out of the way. It's not in the Australian public consciousness because it's politically convenient. Now, the less the Australian public thinks about our diggers being involved in anything over there.
So what are they involved in? Today
in Iraq?
In Iraq
we did very little. I mean, it was a little bit of a joke. I thought it was unkind to the diggers. I mean, they were stuck. Our battalion group was stuck.
So where?
In the most remote part of the
about?
Desert, in the most remote, you know, the most peaceful part of Iraq, so there wouldn't be any body bags, essentially. In Afghanistan, however, our boys are putting in a big way. And I know there was a thing on Media Watch last year, and I've since caught up on the debates about the nature of the media coverage and the Australian Defence Forces policies. All I can tell you is this. I've worked with just about, you know, I've certainly worked with every military, modern Western military, fighting in the so-called war on terror. I've also been to the wars in Georgia. I cover the Mexican cartel wars in, you know, over there. I've been to the wars in Lebanon. I mean, the Australian Department of Defence and the Defence Force itself, their media policies are embarrassing. I mean, the Americans, even the Brits, who still remain tight-lipped and you know, still uncomfortable with the media, have a much better, much more successful media policy than we do. We are stuck in the dark ages when it comes to the Australian government and the Defence Force leadership handling our men in contact, our men in combat.
So our men in combat in Afghanistan, what
you wouldn't have a clue
they
what they're doing, would
well,
you?
You've got
to ask
me. Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
Well, that's why you're here.
I mean,
tell me.
The Aussie government doesn't want to know, want you to know the truth, I suppose, because, you know, like I said, it's politically inconvenient.
But you can tell us the truth. So
well,
tell
I haven't. Hey, very few people have spent real time with diggers on, you know, in the real shit, you know. The truth in war lies where the meat meets the metal. Now, that's on the front line. Now, I see that the Australian Defence Force has done, like, these trial embeds, taking a handful of selected journalists over and then wrapping them up in cotton wool balls, against those journalists' objections, as a so-called, you know, insight for the Australian people into what our soldiers are doing. Well, that was just a farce.
All right. So
and our soldiers, now, in Afghanistan, we have an infantry group that's there under Dutch command supporting a reconstruction effort in a province in Afghanistan. I know, like, the back of my hand. I mean, in Afghanistan, let me just preface it by saying, I am Afghani, you know. Assalamu alaikum, study masri, sange, jode, pche, sahaldis. Ma nom bismillah khandi. I'm Pashto. I come from the Taliban tribe, right? I really went native. So I know the area where the Aussies are operating, like the back of my hand. I know the men they're fighting and killing. So I know I'm pretty much, you know, I've been in Iraq, only just paying small attention to Afghanistan, but I do know what our lads are up to and what they're up against. So you have the infantry there under Danish command, and those boys are out there doing patrols. And on patrol, you can patrol 1,000 times and nothing happens until that one that,
does
you know,
happen.
You come back without that leg. Then you have an entire regiment of our special air service over there. Now, you know, oh, they're special, you know, they're SAS, that's super secret, media shy, and there's good reasons for that. There's good reasons why soldiers don't like journalists. However, you know, journalists are a tool in any war, and our boys over there are really getting into it, trust me.
So
they're taking out the Taliban's mid-ranking leadership. You know, our boys are spilling blood and in a very effective way, and they're doing glorious things in silence, and I'm sorry, that offends me. And to say that, you know, we can't talk about these things for operational security, meaning, you know, if we talk about these things afterwards, you know, this will affect the security of our soldiers still in the field. What a load of God's wallop. I challenge the Minister of Defence to bring that on. Oh my God,
all
let
right.
me.
But can I go back to you? Because this is where this started.
Who cares about me? But, I mean, let's think about the soldiers and their families. What the families go through.
But you're home for a break because you're suffering post-traumatic stress.
You wouldn't know it, would you?
Will you go back?
Oh, if situation arises, yeah.
If doctors allow you, or if you feel
the doctors, who gives a shit about the doctors?
But if you feel as though you're up to, under what conditions would you go back?
If there's a good story.
Yes.
A story that had to be told. And this is the other thing. You know, there's stories that just don't get told.
All right, but the Michael Ware story. When do you decide?
That's the most boring story
of all.
Yes,
well, I want to hear about it. So just briefly in summing up, how long are you back in Brisbane for?
Turns out for another year.
For another year?
Yes.
So can we have a view back for another chat in a little time?
You are a glutton for punishment, darling.
I am a glutton for punishment.
Well,
you've always known that.
Yeah, I came home on book leave, and then there was a bit of thing with my current employers. There was some confusion, and now I'm home for a year. And it turns out it's a good thing to be home. It's nice to actually be back.
Well, I certainly think your family think that too.
I'm sure they do.
Michael Ware, thank you very much for your time, and we look forward to talking again soon.
It was my pleasure anyway.